From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by the Interventional Institute at Holy Name Hospital, offering non-surgical treatment options for people with inoperable or chronic conditions such as cancer, peripheral artery disease, uterine fibroids, and varicose veins. More at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Shani Jardin.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There is no such thing as a global First Amendment or an international protocol on free speech. This has been crystallized in the fallout over a set of Danish cartoons depicting the prophet Muhammad. The cartoons were first published in the Danish paper Jyllands-Posten in September, and among other things, one depicts the prophet with a bomb-shaped turban. Muslims were shocked to see the images. It is against tradition to depict the prophet in any way. The newspaper apologized, and for some Muslim leaders in Denmark, that apology was good enough, but not for others in Muslim countries. Throughout the Muslim world, there have been boycotts of Danish goods and demands for more apologies from the Danish prime minister. This week, papers throughout Western Europe reprinted the highly controversial images. Arms have been raised and death threats issued. Susan Caskey reads the papers from around the globe for The Week magazine. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Tell me why these newspapers reprinted the offensive cartoons this week and why Jyllands-Posten published them in the first place.
It started last September when a Danish children's author, Kara Blutgen, was complaining in Danish papers that he had been writing a children's book about the life of the prophet Muhammad, and he couldn't find any illustrators. It's forbidden in Islam to depict Muhammad, even in a favorable manner. So Jyllands-Posten issued a kind of a challenge to cartoonists in Denmark, and they got 12 cartoons, some of which were very inoffensive. Others, like you mentioned, the one with the turban as a bomb, more offensive. That was September of last year. And the head of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is a group of Muslim countries across the world, began talking to Danish diplomats and Danish editors saying, well, we're offended by this as Muslims and we would like some sort of apology. There were months of negotiation and discussion before finally the Muslim countries said, well, we're tired of waiting for this apology. And this week is when a few demonstrations began breaking out.
And at that point, this fairly obscure event had turned into a news event.
Exactly. A Norwegian paper took up the cause and republished the cartoons out of solidarity with the Danes, and then more protests started. Then this week, on Wednesday, a French newspaper, François, published the cartoons, and it caused an outcry among French Muslims. So that very night, the managing editor of François was fired. And the next day, the editor-in-chief wrote another editorial saying, we would have done the same thing if it had been the Pope being mocked or a rabbi being mocked, and we stand by our right to do this. And that's when all of Europe pretty much ignited, at least the European journalistic community. On Thursday, we started seeing the republication of these drawings in German newspapers, in Dutch newspapers, in Italian papers.
Publishing the pictures just to explain what all the commotion was about, no?
Partly to explain what the commotion was about, also partly to demonstrate their right to do so. Almost in every case, the publication of the drawings was accompanied by a sort of hand-wringing editorial where the editors would say, you know, we discussed long and hard and we anguished about this and we decided we're going to run it because even though it's offensive, we have this right to free speech.
Let's just assume that at best it was a foolish decision to run the original cartoon because, after all, it was a bit gratuitous. But in the West, we are accustomed to greeting editorial judgments by firing off a sharply worded letter and not by burning flags and saying, death to Denmark. I got to tell you, it's a phrase I never really thought I would hear chanted. What is the difference between Muslim cultures and Western culture that permits this kind of reaction to a newspaper's decision to print something?
Part of it is just the perception of what the role of the press is and to what extent is a press free. certainly in most of the Arab world, and to a lesser extent in other parts of the Muslim world, Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, the press is not particularly free. And this means that whatever is published in the newspaper is also sanctioned by the government. So for the Arab populations that are offended by a cartoon in a Western paper, they're going to assume that the government of that country is behind it. And so there's not a distinction being made between the Danish journalists and the Danish government. And in fact, the Danish Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, came out and said, look, I'm sorry that Muslims are offended, but my government had nothing to do with this. You know, we have a free press here, and I think it was tacky of them to run it, but it's their right. But that has not appeased these populations at all, and there's continued calls for boycotts.
I wonder if the Western European press, which has notably been so, you know, I guess sympathetic to oppressed Muslims around the world, have you noticed a sort of loss of patience with the world community of Islam over this kind of reaction to what we here in the West see as just sort of daily journalism?
Yes, definitely. There's been a loss of patience. In fact, several of the editorials even mentioned that. They said, you know, we've put up with demonstrations against this and that, but when you start to threaten people with death because they are cartoonists illustrating something, many of them invoked the image of a line in the sand and said, look, we're willing to be sensitive, we're willing to be tolerant, but you, our Muslim populations, have to be tolerant as well. And in this society, we have a right to free speech. You have a right to say you're offended by it, but that's where it ends.
Okay. Well, Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Susan Caskey is the international editor for The Week magazine.
Among the governments demanding an official apology from Denmark is Iran. Not terribly surprising. Over the years, Iran hasn't exactly been an oasis of independent journalism. But that hasn't stopped Iranians of all stripes from expressing themselves on the web. About 5 million of them are now online, and more than 100,000 of them are blogging. Stanford researchers say that Persian is now the third most common language on the internet. It's an encouraging sign to many in the West who see Iran's thriving blogosphere as the catalyst for political change. But in this month's New Republic, Joseph Browdy argues that the internet might forestall democracy and actually serve to maintain the status quo. He joins me now to explain. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Hi, Shani.
What are the demographics generally of internet users? Who's online?
These are urban elites. They tend to be middle class and higher Iranians who have always had access to the latest technologies, whether it be satellite technology, which arrived en masse in Iran in the 80s and 90s, or more recently, the internet. I've seen the figure 700,000 Iranian bloggers globally. Persians outside Iran have encouraged and emboldened internet users inside the country to challenge and push against the limits of free expression. The government, for its part, has accused Iranians from the outside of being involved with CIA efforts to destabilize the country, some perhaps justly and others surely unjustly.
But there are internet filters put in place by the government?
That's absolutely right. In fact, in recent years, the Iranian government has reached out to an American company, Secure Computing, to put in smart filter. What is being filtered out is, first of all and foremost, dissident bloggers, especially in the Persian language, some religious content that is injurious to Shi'i Islam. They're also interested in filtering out pornographic content, and they've been very effective at doing that.
While access to the internet inside Iran has expanded, though, you say that public life has grown increasingly restrictive. So does access to the internet then become a kind of a pressure valve for the average younger Iranian?
The government, while eager to curtail expressions by Iranians that may threaten the status quo, they also are not objecting to the use of the internet to learn more about the world, to experience a secular, wayward lifestyle as long as it's not outwardly manifested. They can meet members of the opposite sex through internet chat forums where it's even illegal to hold hands in public. They can download movies on the internet that cannot legally be viewed in an Iranian cinema. So it's making some of the trappings of a free public domain available in the private sphere, and that's making life more livable and perhaps less different than life anywhere else.
Now, I want to get to an interesting argument that you made in this piece. You said, if I understand you correctly, that people outside of Iran may look at the changes that are happening with internet use and jump to mistaken conclusions, and that maybe some of this internet openness actually has a negative consequence. Can you explain what you meant?
Those who see the internet uptake and assume it means revolution or it means radical change, it means there's no way things can stay the same in Iran with so many people online, that may be a leap in logic that I wouldn't be prepared to take. When there is a revolution in some authoritarian state, I have no doubt that the revolutionaries will use the blogosphere because it is a mighty tool. But that doesn't mean that the presence of a blogosphere is going to bring about a revolution. On the contrary, other aspects of internet use are going to maintain public order by giving people valves to enjoy themselves in private.
There's been a lot of news in recent weeks and a lot of debate about the roles and the practices that American media and internet companies ought to follow when engaging in business in China. How is Iran's treatment of the internet different than what is taking place in China?
Actually, Iran and China are very similar in terms of the evolution of the government policy toward the internet. In both countries, they began with the crude measure of a sweep of internet cafes. A few years later, both countries have learned that the more subtle tactic of filtration enables the government to filter out much of the content that is harmful to them, but the society to enjoy the content that is benign to the government.
So in the past year, we've seen a number of bloggers imprisoned, but then we've also seen this very inspiring growth of online discourse. What do you imagine we'll see next?
First of all, the Iranian government forecast that 4 years from now, there may be as many as 25 million people online. That's an enormous portion of a population, a country of about 69 million people, to have the chance at the touch of a button to get in touch with Americans, Europeans, Israelis for that matter, and many others. I think that the fact that so many of the Persian blogs also are done in English means that Americans can be reading this material, learning more about Iran from the perspective of young people in that country. In the long run, the blogosphere will have a lot to do with the way that the United States and Iran understand each other.
Joseph, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Joseph Browdy is the author of The New Iraq, Rebuilding the Country for Its People, the Middle East, and the World, and is a weekly columnist for The New Republic.
Coming up, the new head of PBS prepares for action.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Shani Jardin, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution is basically a bare-bones job description for the nation's president. The first section lays out the prerequisites, and the last details the procedures for early termination. In between, there's just two other sections. One expounds on the basic powers of the office, and the other requires that the president, from time to time, give to Congress information of the State of the Union. That's it. From time to time, not every year. Give information, not proffer a laundry list of policy initiatives and market-tested political rhetoric. But over the years, the basic mandate has spawned an elaborate annual rite. On the eve of this past Tuesday's latest installment, Slate political correspondent John Dickerson offered a brief history of that spectacle. Turns out, it was not always thus.
Presidents have not always had to do it in person. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, in 1801, stopped the ceremony. He said it smacked too much of the British monarchy, and so he delivered his address by mail. And that was continued for about 100 years when Woodrow Wilson revived the ceremony and started doing it in person again. And it was done in the afternoon. It was not the major national event that it is now. Of course, there weren't televisions at that point, but it took Lyndon Johnson to move it into prime time to turn the State of the Union into the massive media national spectacle that it is now.
So as the State of the Union moved into becoming, well, a media event, how did that affect the content and the role of the State of the Union culturally?
Well, it started to become a more political speech. When Johnson in 1966 put it into prime time, that was the first time the opposition party, in that case the Republicans, insisted on having a response to the president. And that really locked it in as a purely political speech. If Thomas Jefferson were alive today, he would weep watching the president walk into the House chamber because members of Congress, they paw at him. They shake his hand. They smile. They kiss him in some instances. And it's as if they're trying to, you know, touch the hem of the royal garment. And the members of Congress are doing this, of course, because they want to be seen in prime time back in the home district with the president.
So, John, this evolution into theatrics also includes other players other than the president taking part in this.
That's right. Well, Ronald Reagan, the former actor, knew how to spruce up an event. So one year, he began the tradition of pointing to members in the balcony.
In the midst of a terrible tragedy on the Potomac, we saw again the spirit of American heroism at its finest. And we saw the heroism of one of our young government employees, Lenny Skutnik, who, when he saw a woman lose her grip on the helicopter line, dived into the water and dragged her to safety.
And so he pointed to Lenny Skutnik. And now we are stuck with that tradition of pointing to members in the gallery, which the president did on Tuesday evening, pointing out a family of a slain U.S. serviceman.
So you also talked about the applause race during the address. What's wrong with a little bit of applause?
Well, nothing's wrong with a little bit of applause. It's just that when it becomes really a line of applause interrupted by a speech, then that kind of gets the order wrong. And this is, in fact, our fault. The press used to treat, and still does in some ways, the number of applause interruptions as if it's a gauge of something serious. John Kennedy's first State of the Union address in 1961, the New York Times mentioned the fact that Kennedy had gotten, I think it was 30-some-odd interruptions in his speech, and that that was different from the average that Eisenhower had gotten. They were measuring quite seriously the number of interruptions and using them as a gauge to inform readers about how much the Congress approved of the president's program.
In your Slate piece, it's almost like you're tracing an arc of the State of the Union from its beginnings as a primarily text-based document to something that was delivered orally to something that became a media event. And I'm wondering what you see the next phase in that evolution. I mean, is this something that the president could conceivably just email, you know, BCCing the rest of the nation?
That would be a great idea. It would spare us some of this. I say that, though, but Americans like their rituals, and it's important to have ceremonies every once in a while as long as we all don't take them too seriously. But I think it would be great if the president would put out a text of his speech and have the proposals that he offers be, say, hyperlinked to items in his budget. Presidents always put out their budget a few days after the State of the Union, and it often contradicts what's been said in the State of the Union. And it would be great to be able to sort of see those side by side. I think also it would be clever, no White House would want to do this, but certainly it would be clever for some journalist to take the previous year's speech and hyperlink the promises there to the actual realities as they came to pass. So there are lots of ways that you can sort of annotate the speeches to keep the president honest, because one of the problems with it becoming a show and becoming a political act is that it encourages lots of applause lines that tend to be divorced from the reality of the world. And it also encourages the kind of political rhetoric that's maybe fine for a convention, but there's, you know, it's a good thing we only have them every 4 years. It's usually the kind of thing that gets everybody cheering, but that doesn't usually lead to a lot of good solutions.
Maybe if they just sent it out as a text message to phones, that'd solve the wordiness problem, because then you'd be limited to, 162 characters.
That's right. It would force them into incredibly succinct thinking. That's right.
Well, John Dickerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
John Dickerson is chief political correspondent for Slate.
Come March, Paula A. Kerger of New York City's public television station WNET will succeed Pat Mitchell as president and CEO of the public broadcasting service, PBS. She takes office in the wake of the most contentious period in PBS's history, the crusade by then Corporation for Public Broadcasting chairman Kenneth Tomlinson to eliminate what conservatives see as a liberal political bias in public TV. Tomlinson himself resigned from the CPB in November in advance of a CPB Inspector General's report concluding he misused CPB money in a liberal bias witch hunt. But he was replaced by another Republican appointee, Cheryl Halpern. This is the status quo Paula Kerger inherits, and she joins me now. Paula, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Of course, I think that's probably how the devil greets newcomers at the gates of hell. Can we just go down a checklist of reasons why you'd have to be crazy to take this job and just get your reaction to them, okay?
Okay.
Paula, public broadcasting has been ground zero in the culture wars, and Bush administration appointees have unapologetically had PBS in their sights for 3 years. Now you take the top job there. Well, first of all, what are you expecting?
Bob, I've been in public broadcasting for 13 years. And so I do, I think, have a pretty good idea of what I'm walking into. And, you know, this is the good fight.
Were you able to extract from the PBS board or even CPB promises that you'll be, you know, left alone, at least editorially, to do your job and to create the kind of programming that people expect from PBS?
Public broadcasting really is the stations across the country. It's not really a place in Washington. The whole editorial control of what ends up on a public television station is really handled at the local level. And what PBS does is aggregate resources. Now, to answer your question, in terms of the board, the PBS board was unanimous in their support for me and was unanimous in their signal to me that they will stand behind me to work to make public broadcasting as strong as it needs to be. And I have had already conversations this week with Patricia Harrison at CPB, and I very much look forward to working with her to ensure that public television maintains its strength, its vitality, and its independence. I think that's just critical.
Well, that's nice. But, of course, Patricia Harrison has her own, very strong Republican bona fides. And if just hypothetically she came to you and said, you know what, Wall Street Journal report was nice to balance the leftist tilt of public broadcasting service programs, but maybe we can have yet more right-wing programming to just make sure everything's in balance. You know, what do you say?
The Patricia Harrison that I've gotten to know over the last 6 months does not strike me as the kind of person that's going to make a comment like that. And I do think that when you look at the public broadcasting schedule, we need to make sure that we are presenting a multiplicity of viewpoints. But I really don't think that that's going to be an issue for us in this coming year. I really don't.
Getting back to the checklist of reasons why you have apparently taken leave of your senses in accepting this position. Now, you have a reputation as a crackerjack fundraiser, and you're walking into an organization that is not exactly awash in cash. How are you going to come up with the dough to keep PBS programming up to the quality that we've all come to expect?
I think one of the important things that happened over the last 2 years. In fact, I would say in thinking about Pat Mitchell's legacy, to me, it's the most significant thing that she accomplished was the creation of the PBS Foundation. And the foundation has existed for a little more than a year. We raised $13 million in the first year, and I see the great potential for it. You know, I think that your question about programming is such a key one because, to me, the most heartbreaking position to be in is to sit opposite a desk of a producer that has a really fabulous idea and know that you don't have the resources to make that project happen, or know that it's going to take 4 or 5 years to get a project to air. I think of the Broadway series that was premiered last year. I think it took 8 years to raise the money for that project.
Yeah, not to be too much of a smart aleck about it, but $13 million, give that woman one white chip. We need a whole stack of purple chips to really fund public broadcasting into the future, no?
Of course, but it's a start.
Allow me, please, to play devil's advocate here. Way back when Newt Gingrich was talking about the contract with America and plans to zero out public broadcasting, you know, even 10 years ago, the argument was that with cable being as ubiquitous as it now is, and the Discovery Channel and History Channel and Independent Film Channel and Sundance and so forth, producing programming that is very similar to that which has traditionally appeared on PBS, that PBS has really outlived its usefulness. Has PBS in any way become obsolete?
During the argument over the contract with America, the public spontaneously rose up and signaled to their representatives that public broadcasting was extraordinarily important to them. This past year, you know, sort of flash forward now 11 years, and it was the same immediate response. I was spending time in Washington visiting with the New York delegation, and again, offices told me they were getting more phone calls on this issue than any other issue. This was not an organized campaign. This was the American people reaching out to their elected officials, letting them know that public television is a critical part of their life. To me, this signaled that public broadcasting is unique and different and treasured by the people of this country. And I think the moment that it's not, then we shouldn't exist. But I believe this is our legacy over the last 40-some years, and I think this will be, in fact, our legacy moving forward. We are television of and by the people.
Congratulations once again, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Paula Kerger is the newly appointed president and CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service.
The city of Los Angeles and the car chase are like love and marriage. Hannity and Combs, yin and yang, a phenomenon springing from the very makeup of the sprawling freeway-tangled city.
Okay, here it goes. He's in the center divider, but there's a CHP officer blocking the center.
Helicopter video crews wait at the airport for just the right police scanner alert and rotor aloft at the drop of an accelerator. Then, to the live video feed, breathless anchors narrate the freeway drama.
Right there. There goes the spike strip. He ran right over on the right side.
Why are there so many police pursuits in L.A., and how did they become such a popular spectacle? Tad Friend recently took a long look at this automotive and media phenomenon for The New Yorker, and he joins me now. Tad, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
Can you kind of take us through the chronology of the televised car chase? How has this kind of grown up in front of our eyes?
Well, the first televised car chase was occurred in 1990. There was a couple named Bob and Marie Couture who later became famous for being the first couple. They had their own helicopter, and they were the first couple to find where O.J. Simpson was on the freeway in 1994. And they were also the couple that shot Reginald Denny being beaten senseless in the riots of 92. And there was a programmer named Jeff Wald, who's now at KTLA, which was then a sort of struggling station. And he thought, well, let's go live with these things. They're cheap to produce. People like to watch them. What can it hurt? So he kind of gave the tourists carte blanche to fly around listening to their scanner. Marika would hang out the window of the helicopter, and Bob would narrate the chases, and they would film them from Marika's shoulder camera. And it turned out people really loved to watch them. A couple years later, there was a chase. Five stations went live with it. And when KCOP cut away from it to go back to Matlock, viewers called in and said, what about that chase? And that was basically the day that the chase was born.
You have something that becomes like an instant and temporary reality TV show. Can you sketch out for us the elements that make a dramatic car chase broadcast? Who are the players? What's the narrative?
The narrative tends to be someone who is really desperate to get away. And if it's at night, one hopes they've hit a spike strip that's been laid in front of them, and their tires are blown, and they're fishtailing a little bit, and there are sparks coming out of their rims. That's always good. Often, for some reason, there seems to be a phenomenon whereby people who've actually driven extremely well, threading through traffic at high speed, avoiding the police, not hitting anything, suddenly take it into their heads to pull off the freeway and then head into a parking lot of a fast food joint. I don't know why this is, but it always happens. And they invariably are instantly caught in the fast food place. But there seems to be some kind of like, I've been driving for 3 hours. I really need a Whopper. And that's what brings them down.
Nothing like a good donut at the end of the chase for the chasee.
Exactly. Except the donut will be enjoyed in jail.
What does this tell us about class distinctions in L.A.?
Well, I think there is a sort of uncomfortable way in which people in the kind of higher rent areas of a town, which are often physically elevated or above the sort of flatter, poorer areas of the city, and they often sort of feel like they're looking down on both literally and figuratively the areas where chases tend to originate. And it tends to be true that by and large, the head of Sony or Paramount or the head of Boeing doesn't tend to be the guy who's running away from the cops at top speed.
Well, what is it about Los Angeles in particular that has made this place the car chase capital of the world?
Well, there are a lot of sort of pointy-headed explanations that have to do with the fact that Los Angeles has more cars registered in it than all but seven states. And there are some 22,000 miles of roads. And so that visually, if you're on the ground, it can appear as if you have endless opportunities to escape just because there's so many roads, so many freeways. My favorite explanation was offered by Sheriff Lee Baca, Sheriff of L.A. County, who sort of delivered a three-part exegesis about it. First of all, we have fewer cops, which is true. LA doesn't have many cops, so it seems like you can get away. And second of all, everyone has a car. And third of all, we have more idiots than anywhere else.
You know, we talk a lot about the media attention on the crazy guy behind the wheel leading the chase, but the media attention on law enforcement in these chases, does that change the behavior of law enforcement over time? I mean, now that they're effectively starring in this reality show as it's being broadcast?
Well, the Sheriff's Department shows a number of chases to its deputies when it's training them in high-speed driving. And one of the chases they show is one where a bunch of deputies beat up a guy who they captured, you know, like, do not do this. They also announce code 1022 when the media helicopters are in the area, which means officially this has now become a newsworthy event. And unofficially sort of means, so please don't hit anyone. Chief Bratton a few years ago tried to get the TV stations to stop showing them all together. It had an effect of about 2%, and all the stations immediately went back to it.
Well, this is certainly something that we see in movies, in television, dramatic television, scripted television. Is the televised L.A. reality car chase, is this something that's here to stay?
It seems to be pretty solid. There are more than 7,000 chases last year in L.A. County. Most of them are pretty short, less than 2 minutes, but a lot of them go on long enough for the helicopters to get there. There are some 13 or 14 new helicopters that are looking around for this stuff, and people will watch it.
Well, Ted, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Ted Friend writes The New Yorker's occasional Letter from California.
Coming up, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the comedy club.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Shani Jardin with a few of your letters. Professor Richard Sloan of Columbia University Medical Center in New York writes, "Your speculation, endorsed by your guest, was that George Bush's losing battle with a pretzel was evidence of an undisclosed heart condition, possibly explaining that squarish bulge on his back during the first debate with John Kerry. That is, the bulge might be an electrical device designed to control atrial fibrillation, the same condition that his father had. Pacemakers, the devices that perform this function, are implanted in the chest and not visible in outline on a person's back. Whatever that bulge was, it was not a pacemaker.
Mark Shubin, also of New York City, observes that our guest Time Magazine's James Poniewozik was, quote, incorrect that a television character president must belong to a political party. President Mackenzie Allen on Commander-in-Chief doesn't. Furthermore, one of her first acts in office was naming her Democratic opponent as vice president. In a recent show, she brought in her Republican archenemy, the Speaker of the House, to play a key role in resolving a crisis.
Many listeners wrote to let us know that our interview with Massey Rich on how the press have misreported on lobbyist Jack Abramoff's giving to Republicans and Democrats didn't go into as much detail as they would have liked to hear. Though we did dispel the line that Abramoff gave to both parties, we agree that we did not report on another interesting way to look at the numbers. That is, how the Indian tribes' giving changed after they hired Abramoff. Gretchen Griffin of Keene, New Hampshire writes, "The report missed what the general media seemed to have missed, that while Abramoff's tribal clients did give money to Democrats, they gave less overall than they had before hiring him."
Keep sending your letters to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
A month or so ago, this office received a fateful press release. It announced a contest for the funniest reporter in New York, a charity benefit sponsored by New York's Laugh Factory Comedy Club. We threw it out because we smelled a publicity stunt. But Bob, who thinks he's funny, dug it out of the trash. Thus began a saga, a journey, an odyssey into one man's psyche, one man's quest, one man's grotesquely inflated ego. That man is our very own Bob Garfield.
You know me, of course, as the dean of media-related radio news magazine Male Co-Hosts, with all the power and gravitas that implies. What perhaps you don't know is that I am a very humorous individual. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Of course, I think that's probably how the devil greets newcomers at the gates of hell. Can we just go down a checklist? Devil. Bob, you're a caution. But stand-up comedy is more than just natural-born hilarity. It's also about timing and writing, confidence and skill. It's about standing on stage exposed and asking an audience of total strangers to like you. That doesn't just happen spontaneously. If I were to be crowned funniest reporter in New York, I'd have to, you know, write some jokes and practice them.
And this is very important. Never, ever lie to your children. Unless they ask you about the 70s. My son said, "Dad, did you ever use..."
At least once a day and twice when I was really grimy, I honed my material to perfection. But my labors didn't end there. As this was a contest, I also needed to size up the competition. The performers would include acts from Forbes, MSNBC, Bloomberg News, the New York Press, and the always entertaining New Jersey Suburban Parent. This opposition research was quite revealing, especially when I met Chester Dawson, an editor late of Business Week magazine, who immediately dropped a bombshell.
What I found, and I've done a few open mics just to test things out, it seems like this, and of course those audiences.
Wait.
It's like you're
in front of an audience?
I have indeed done a little bit, and I highly recommend that you do so too.
Wow, actual comedy experience. But instead of being intimidated, I chose to learn, soaking up knowledge about challenges I'd never even imagined, like the nightmare of getting lost on stage in the middle of a joke.
Don't be a self-critic while you're on stage. I mean, don't tell people, "Oh, that wasn't funny." You've got to be like a shark. You've always got to be moving forward. You never go back. If it doesn't work, you just move on. And that's tough.
I must say, despite Chester's cautionary words, I was feeling pretty good about my chances. My material was coming along pretty well, and I was beginning to work out the rough spots in my delivery.
And I was honest. I told him I experimented with illegal drugs 2,000 or 3,000 times in the 70s, but
But then in another press release from the Laugh Factory, I saw an updated roster of performers, and one name stopped me in my tracks. Jamie McIntyre, Pentagon correspondent for CNN.
Defense Secretary Rumsfeld denied that the phrase "the long war" meant that U.S. troops would be deployed in Iraq and other places indefinitely. In fact, Admiral Giambastiani made the point that an area the size of Kentucky, the state of Kentucky, has been turned over to Iraqi control just in the past several days.
All right, not his strongest material, but not only is he reputed to be one of the funniest defense correspondents ever, he has my dream job. When I was a youngster, all I ever wanted to do was wander the Pentagon waiting for Donald Rumsfeld not to answer my questions. And here McIntyre basically snatched my destiny from my hands. So now at last would come the showdown, and I was determined to find out what this joker was up to. But, like the defense secretary he covers, he's pretty cagey himself.
There's huge swaths of potential comic material that are sort of off limits. I can't make too much fun of the people at CNN because I got to work with them.
Oh, shucks, I don't have a chance. Anyway, I can't even do my best material.
Fine, I'll let him play that game. But this funny reporter decided to report.
Say something funny.
See, that's it. There's nothing less funny than somebody trying to be funny.
Are you going to work blue?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to work blue?
Are
you going to be filthy?
I thought about it because...
Are you going to say
Because...
Are you going to say
Because...
Are you going to say
Well, because it's interesting you should say that.
Are you going to say
Probably not.
This was not idle inquiry. In my weeks of preparation, I'd come up with quite a few very good jokes, and almost every one of them was unforgivably filthy or worse. But could I perform them in public? Me? The dean of media-related radio news magazine male co-hosts? It was a conundrum, but no use fretting, because soon enough, the moment of truth had arrived. Within moments of arriving at the Laugh Factory, I found myself face-to-face with one of the celebrity judges, the legendary Pat Cooper, who was kind enough to share his perspective on the event and my prospects.
What are you doing? Are you nuts? No, because they're surely going to win here. Why? Why should you be under pressure for nothing?
That's pretty much when it should have been clear that, though I was showered fresh and clean, my problems were just beginning. Problem number one, now that I look back on it, was that some of the contestants in the Funniest Reporters contest were not reporters at all. Among them was Katie Lazarus, who qualified on the basis of contributing humor columns to the New York Jewish Forward.
I opened for Lewis Black on Monday, and I performed at Caroline's on Tuesday, and on Friday I'll be at Gotham Comedy Club.
The second problem was that most of the contestants were not actual comedians, and when the competition got underway, the audience was not especially forgiving.
I've heard that some people would rather be dead than speak in public. Tonight I get to speak and hope my jokes don't die. But
reporters have lost credibility in the minds of the general consumer to the point where I think O.J. Simpson is more credible when talking about how to be a good husband. Of course, O.J. couldn't be here tonight. He's still out catching the real killers. How we doing?
In his... He ruled my world.
It's a good thing I have a day job to fall back on. Wow, you guys are...
Oh, my God. On paper? Gorgeous. I meet him, his profile, written by Jason Blair. I kid you not.
I want to thank that guy in the back row for not yelling out when she talked about her real breasts. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Tasteful. Appreciate it. So anyway, speaking of cancer.
Then there was the third problem. Katie Lazarus and another pro named Tyrone Johnson did work blue.
So I tried to look as sexy as possible, and I put my hair back, and... And as sultry of a voice as I could do, I was like, I just want to in your
So, a girl called me up on my work, and she says, right after work, I'm going to you from them. I said, whoa, from them. That's like Pentium 12. That's some advanced. I mean, I said, does that involve the at all, or what?
It did me no good whatsoever when New York television legend Joe Franklin made a surprise appearance. The 52-year TV veteran delivered 52-year-old jokes flawlessly, loosening up the crowd just in time for my nemesis,
Jamie McIntyre!
And he was funny in a maddeningly Letterman-esque way. Relying on the very juicy dishing on CNN colleagues, he swore to me he wouldn't do. Oh, he thought better of it later, worried that a little good-natured joshing might be taken the wrong way back in Atlanta. But on stage, he took no prisoners.
Rumsfeld's not really the guy I'm afraid of in my job. The guy I'm afraid of is, and maybe you've seen him on TV. Have you seen? I have to be on his show all the time. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen this. It just happened just to me the other night. I was doing a report about body armor. It was called Body Armor, Fetish, or Fashion Necessity. But I'm on the show. I'm doing a story about body armor, and I swear to God, this is question. At the end of every report, this is what asked me. It's a version of this. Jamie, how could what you've just reported possibly be true? Because it flies in the face of everything I personally believe.
But I'm probably not being quite honest with you, because I haven't yet informed you of the biggest problem of all. The charity beneficiary for the evening was Comedy Cures, a nonprofit dedicated to healing through laughter. The competition of would-be stand-up comics was kicked off by a 6-minute, 19-second presentation from a breast cancer survivor with a message of inspiration.
Last year we did 54 live events for 34,000 people. I am a stage 4 cancer miracle. I am cancer-free.
Yeah, that primes the pump for laughter. And some hapless sucker not only had to warm up a cold audience, the poor schnook had to follow that. That schnook, it pains me to finally report, had been me. Yeah. First comic standing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Garfield! Here he is!
Thank you, Gersh. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, Bob, go get him. You're on first, right after the cancer lady.
Truth be told, it started off just fine. And I realized everything I'd ever heard about live comedy is true. You stand up there in the glare of the spotlight, naked and alone, willing to do anything for a laugh. One of my colleagues, for instance, removed 13 pocketbook items from her bra. But I just couldn't work blue. So I settled on aquamarine.
I have myself had some near-death experiences in a hotel. I was in Chicago, the 57th floor of the Hilton and Towers, 4 o'clock in the morning, bolt upright in bed, fire alarm. Naturally, I evacuated immediately, and then I gathered my stuff and ran out of the room. I was Voltaren for arthritis, Zetia and Lipitor for cholesterol, Prilosec for the ever-sexy reflux disease. And I probably should use Viagra, too, but I can't stand all the hugging afterwards. You know, Stone Phillips, Anderson Cooper, Shepard Smith, Wasp. See, Jews can't do that. Jews can't use last names as first names. This is Teitelbaum Moskowitz, and here are tonight's headlines. It just doesn't scan, and it...
And, man, it was working. They were laughing. They liked me. It was the most satisfying, exhilarating, powerful feeling I've had since my back-to-back interviews on broadcast deregulation. And then, as if ordained by the gods of comedy, I got lost.
One small polyp and a brand new Starbucks. The doctor said, asked me about my lifestyle. He said, I don't know, business casual? It turns out he was talking about drug use. And I was honest. I admitted that there were, you know, 2 or 3 times. This is really going well.
You've got to be like a shark. You've always got to move forward.
I admitted that God, I am a funny, funny man.
Don't tell people that wasn't funny.
I admitted that I did use illegal drugs. I experimented with illegal drugs 2,000 or 3,000 times in the 70s, but...
Oh, I recovered all right, but the brief comedy mini-stroke set me off my stride. The feeling of omnipotence slipped away, leaving a void, in Pentagon terms, the size of Kentucky. And it would take 3 hours for me to see if the judges noticed, too.
So, finishing in third place, the CNN guy, Jamie McIntyre. Where is he? Tied for third with Jamie McIntyre is our own Joe Franklin. There he is, ladies and gentlemen. He stayed up. Finishing in second place. That's right, it's the in this guy. Tyrone Johnson. Where is he, Tyrone? And our winner tonight, who goes on to the funniest reporter contest in the entire world, Katie Lazarus. Where is she, everybody? Katie, oh, my God. The humanity. They're jumping from the top. And, oh, this is horrible, but it's great. Here she is, ladies and gentlemen.
So, as it turns out, I'm between the 5th and 18th funniest reporter in New York, which I can live with. Comedy Cures raised a few $1,000s. The Laugh Factory got a lot of cheap publicity. And most of all, I learned something about myself. Call it a newfound sense of purpose. Call it what you will, but I know this. Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and Margaret Cho don't know about media criticism. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited this week by committee. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen, and with tears in our eyes, we say goodbye this week to Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Thanks for all your help, guys. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. And email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be reporting from Israel next week. I'm Shani Jardin.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.